Good afternoon. We will call this meeting of the Climate and Energy Committee to order. And we do have a quorum. Representative Kraft, have you had a chance to look at the meeting minutes from January 31st?
I have, and I would move their approval, Madam Chair.
Great. Any discussion to the meeting minutes from the 31st? Seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion prevails, and the minutes are adopted. Today on the agenda, we've got a couple of bills that we're hearing. First up, we have Representative Ryer with House File 747. And I'll move that House File 747 will be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, welcome to committee, Representative Ryer. Would you like to tell us about your bill? Oh, and I see we have an A5. So Representative Ryer has an author's amendment that is coded A5. I'll move the A5 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. Any discussion on the A5? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A5, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed, say nay.
No.
Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Representative Ryer, now that the bill is in the shape that you would like it to be, will you please tell us about the amended bill, please?
Thank you, Chair Acom. Thank you, committee members. It's a pleasure to be here. House File 747 is a bill that establishes a grant program to fund the installation of solar panels on local public buildings. This grant program will be funded by the Renewable Development Account, or RDA, and the General Fund, and the program will be administered by the Department of Commerce. An appropriation amount is still being determined. As we see the effects of the climate crisis become more severe, it's essential that we use all the tools at our disposal to mitigate the effects. At the same time, with declines in the cost of solar energy, use has expanded from our largest utilities all the way down to individual homeowners. Minnesota stands to benefit from increasing our use of solar, and this program puts the tools in the hands of local government units that may not otherwise be able to afford it. It helps them stabilize energy costs while addressing climate change. In this program, towns, cities, counties, and tribal governments can apply for grants to install solar panels on local buildings, for example, a library, community center, or water treatment plant. It's a statewide program that can benefit rural, suburban, and urban communities alike. Solar on public buildings brings tangible benefits. For example, we lived in an apartment building with a solar panel installation. Solar provided power to all our common spaces, with some left over. We can enjoy these benefits on our public buildings, too. Our communities are looking ahead to a sustainable future. In Eagan, redevelopment of the police station included a roof built to accommodate solar in the future. Our communities are ready for this. Let's take this opportunity to invest in their energy future. I'd like to turn it over now to our testifiers to talk more about the program and its benefits. Thank you, Chair Acom.
Welcome, Logan O'Grady, Executive Director of MNCEA. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. For the record, my name is Logan O'Grady. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. Been here a couple times now, but just a reminder, MNCEA is a 501c6 trade organization. We are a force of 140 member companies moving Minnesota solar and energy storage forward. I wanted to thank Representative Ryer for, again, authoring this bill. It's been around for a few years now, and it's a really innovative bill. It's a public-private partnership, in a sense, that puts Minnesota at a competitive advantage over other states in our region. As I mentioned in one of the first hearings that I attended this year, some of the legislation that the legislature is going to be considering this year really serve in our members' minds as business signals, showing that Minnesota is a great place to come, open a company, grow your company, hire Minnesotans to do your work. And that's similar to this bill. This bill is very similar to the Solar on Schools program, which has been exceedingly popular throughout the state of Minnesota because it lowers utility bills for local governments and therefore saves taxpayers money. Simultaneously, we're creating great jobs here in Minnesota and opportunities for Minnesotans. As you consider this bill, I'd also just mention that as we look at other programs like this one and other ones throughout the rest of the legislative session. MNCEA is very concerned about transmission issues, making sure that as we bring more solar onto the system, we can actually deliver that to Minnesotans. And so I look forward to continuing our discussion with that and the utilities as well. With that, I have some members here. Otherwise, I can stick around for questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering why this bill is not going to Commerce and it's not going to state and local gov.
I think we've asked chairs if they're interested in seeing it and hearing the bill, and they haven't indicated that they are. It will be here if they request to see it. We're happy to share the bill with them and have them give it a hearing. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Madam Chair, we can't be skipping committees. We've been doing this all session. It's been a month in, and we've been skipping committees left and right. And this is a really important thing. The Department of Commerce is literally in the bill as the arbiter of what's going to happen. There are huge holes in this bill, which I will get to in a minute. And one would think that if you're going to do something for local government, you would include the Committee of Local Government. So this is it's a little bit ridiculous, this expediency that we seem to be under, this pressure we seem to be under. Some would call it the freight train that's coming right at us. Is just, I don't understand what we're doing here. I've been here 11 years. I don't know what we're doing. I don't understand why we're skipping committees. It seems to be in every committee, they're just skipping committees and going straight to the floor or whatever. But this is just not how things are done. I know you haven't been here real long, but you talk to members that have been here over 30 years, and this is just not how things are done. The speed and the skipping committees is just too much. I actually do have some questions about the bill because I don't, even though it's been here for a few years, I don't think this bill is ready by any stretch of the imagination, and I have some serious questions to ask, one of which is there's a reporting requirement to the legislature, it's only like how much money went out and how many kilowatts were put up. It says nothing about what happened after that, like how much energy was actually produced and what kind of impediments did people run into. It's such a scant report to the legislature. That's one question. Is that something that the author would be willing to add into this bill since it is being laid over and skipping to other committees?
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. First of all, I just want to comment that the bill path this year is identical to last year. So it, from my point of view, it is how we've been managing this bill. To the reporting requirements, I am careful about adding burden to local governments in terms of reporting. So I would want to think carefully about that, especially some of the smaller units of government that we hope to help that have very small people who are permanent staff in their city offices. So that would be something to talk about and make sure that we aren't creating problems for the very people we're seeking to assist.
And before turning to another question, I just want to remind the committee that the Department of Commerce is under our jurisdiction here in the Energy Committee. So Representative O'Neill.
While that is true, it should probably go to the committee that deals specifically with commerce. And if commerce wants to come down and talk, I don't know, that's fine too.
We have the chair of the commerce committee here. I think he can probably.
I feel like I was summoned.
I was really meaning the Department of Commerce, but if you want to speak to it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I don't know if Representative Neal, if you were saying that the bill needed to go to the Commerce Committee. You know, we have the energy accounts are within this committee's jurisdiction. We really don't have the energy division under the purview in the Commerce Committee. I just was looking at the bill, and if I had been asked as a chair whether I would see this bill at any point, I would say no, because it's an energy division bill. I don't really know what would even fall under my committee's jurisdiction that's in the bill. I think this is wholly within Chair Akam's jurisdiction because the energy division accounts are all with Chair Akam.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, it's the Department of Commerce here. They don't have a fiscal note, and since it's not going to commerce as a whole.
Looks like John Kelly here. Go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, I'm John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. To your question, Representative O'Neill, we have completed a fiscal note on our end on this bill. We have sent it on to the, it's, I believe, being sent to the Legislative Budget Office today. I will note a couple of things as a preview. Because there are not dollar amounts in this bill currently, we based our assumptions in the fiscal note on the Solar for Schools in Greater Minnesota program that we currently run. And we noted that once there are appropriations, we would need to, and you know, we would need to revise the fiscal note. But we have worked on this fiscal note. I approved it this morning, and it's on its way to the LBO. So that will be coming.
And when we get it, we'll be sure to share the, Representative O'Neill.
Well, typically we wait for the fiscal note before we hear the bill. But okay, we're just gonna, this freight train's gonna keep going. So we're not willing to put any sort of feedback as far as, okay, we know how much we're putting up, we know what the kilowatts are going to be, but we don't know how much is actually being generated because that's too burdensome upon local government, even though we're not going to the local government committee. Okay. Do you have any idea how much you're going to be taking from the general fund and how much you're going to be taking from the RDA?
Representative Breyer.
Madam Chair, Representative, it will be split according to the distribution of coverage for each in the state, and it will, so that it's based on that allocation. And just for the record, I believe I said that I would have conversations about reporting, making sure that it worked for people, not that I would not consider conversations.
Representative O'Neill, did you have more questions, or should we finish with our testifiers?
I have one more question before we get to the rest of testifiers. Okay, thank you. So as I'm reading the bill, I have a concern about the contract. And my concern is the decommissioning and recycling of the solar panels and whose responsibility that is. If it's the developer that is in the contract as responsible and the developer goes bankrupt, which we have seen, at least out in my area, rather often.
Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. That's an area that I'd be happy to discuss further because I think we should have a process in place where that responsibility would devolve to the building that owns it.
Madam Chair, did the author say that it would fall on the building owner?
No, I think she said that she would be willing to talk with you more about it.
Yes.
Representative Breyer, would you like to?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, that would be an option. We should look at possibilities and have a plan. I think that's a good question and one that warrants further conversation since it's being laid over.
Yeah, just really quickly, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that is probably half of the bill because it's one thing to put it up and generate electricity. It's a whole other thing to decommission it and maintain it. Maintenance is also not specified if that developer who is allowed to do the application actually goes bankrupt. And so these small little communities with two or three staff could actually be really underwater and really in trouble if something goes wrong, which it often does. So I hope that you take that into, this really needs to go to state and local government because they're the experts in that area. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And with that, we'll maybe continue on with testifiers. Next, we have Braden Solem with Ideal Energy. Welcome to committee. Enter your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Chair Akin, members of the committee, my name is Braden Solem. I'm the Vice President of Business Development at Ideal Energies. We are a commercial solar developer that focuses heavily on developing projects for Minnesota's public sector. Specifically, we work with many cities, counties, school districts, government entities to develop on-site rooftop solar projects on public buildings that directly offset utility expense. It's what we call behind-the-meter solar. Thank you for allowing me time to speak in support of House File 747. The Solar on Public Buildings program and appropriation will help institutions that would otherwise be unable or unwilling to participate in on-site solar to date. It will help them provide a greater financial return, which will ultimately save taxpayer dollars as these institutions pay less for energy. I specifically want to point out that funding for public entities outside of XL Energy territory is extremely important, as there has historically been no option for these institutions to participate in on-site solar energy. This money will create that opportunity, and we anticipate there will be ample demand for participation. To give some perspective on this potential demand, we can look to the Solar for Schools program for utilities located outside of XL Energy territory, which completed its first round in 2022. There was such significant interest in this program that the Department of Commerce had to limit applications to 2 projects per district in some cases. Similar to many public entities located outside of XL territory, there is little to no opportunity to install commercial-sized solar arrays due to a lack of incentive programs to make these projects financially feasible under typical industry standard financing arrangements. For many, the Solar for Schools program was the first time they have been able to explore on-site solar for their buildings. And from our experience working with districts so far, we found that many have been waiting for an opportunity like this and are excited for the opportunity to participate. It's safe to assume this demand will apply towards all other public entities, and we anticipate there is more than enough demand for this potential program to utilize all potential funding for the program. As you can see, the Solar on Public Buildings program is primed for success. It will offer many cities, counties, and government entities their first opportunity to install solar, and we anticipate they are excited and ready to participate. The result of this program will be a significant reduction in the cost of energy to participating local governments for years to come, while taking an important step towards reducing their community's greenhouse gas emissions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Solom. Next on the list, we have Mike Supina, Eagan City Council member. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Akam and members. My name is Mike Supina. I'm a registered architect and LEED accredited professional. I'm also a council member with the City of Eagan, although I'm testifying in favor of House File 747 today as a private citizen and not representing the official position of the City of Eagan. In recent years, nearly every impediment to widespread conversion to solar energy has been overcome. Solar panels are now cost competitive with fossil fuel energy generation. The impacts of climate change caused by fossil fuel combustion is now undeniable. As more private homes install solar panels, public acceptance has become the norm. The only remaining impediment is the upfront investment for initial installation. That's why House File 747 is such an important bill. Solar energy generation should be standard on any new public building in Minnesota that has favorable solar exposure. But the long-term benefits of solar power are often superseded by more immediate concerns once local governments start making tough decisions about budget priorities. It doesn't need to be that way. Governments own their facilities long enough to realize a return on investment. I would love to see Eagan install solar panels on our public buildings. But I would love even more to see smaller cities in outstate Minnesota have that opportunity, which without state assistance could be a prohibitively costly addition to their small budgets. If state government truly wants to reduce our carbon footprint, it needs to lead by example. We've developed the technology to harness solar energy cleanly and cheaply. All we need now is the political will to make the investment. We can do this. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for being here. Next, we have Isabel Ricker with Fresh Energy, Clean Electricity Director. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Isabel Ricker. I'm the director of the Clean Electricity Program at Fresh Energy. Many of you are familiar with Fresh Energy, but we are a nonpartisan, nonprofit clean energy advocacy organization here in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 747 today. We appreciate the opportunity to share our support for this effort to advance the installation of solar energy on public buildings across the state. As other testifiers have mentioned, over the past decade, solar energy has become one of the cheapest ways, and in many cases, the cheapest way to produce electricity in Minnesota. Minnesota utilities and corporations are investing heavily in solar energy and seeing the financial benefits of shifting to this clean energy resource. This bill will support local and tribal governments in developing solar projects themselves as well, whether that's to reduce their electricity bills or to advance local climate action plans. Solar is an effective tool for public entities looking for long-term energy savings and utility bill stability. Solar provides electricity with zero fuel cost and nearly zero maintenance costs for at least 20 years. This bill ensures that public entities that are considering this cost-effective This bill ensures that public buildings are also considering cost-effective energy conservation measures, which will help maximize their energy savings. This proposal builds on the success of other programs like Solar for Schools to ensure that all types of public facilities, not exclusively schools, can access benefits of solar while reducing greenhouse gas emissions and supporting clean energy jobs here in Minnesota. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Just because we've heard three times, I just have one question for the testifier or any of the previous testifiers. We've had three testifiers say that solar is one of the cheapest or the cheapest form of electricity generation. It just begs the obvious question that if it's so cheap, why do we have to subsidize it? If anyone has a response.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. I think this gets to the point made by the council member from Egan, Mr. Stepina, about the upfront cost of the solar system versus the long-term bill savings and the, you know, relatively tight budgets that many local governments and public entities have. So while it is the cheapest way to produce electricity, it does have an upfront capital cost and then zero fuel cost. So on a levelized basis, it is by far the cheapest in many, many cases. However, it does involve that upfront capital cost, which is a budget challenge for many.
Madam Chair, and to the testifiers, there's a 30% tax credit at the federal level. It's already subsidizing it and reducing the cost by 30%.
Madam Chair, Representative, I agree, and the new federal bill does allow public entities to take that tax credit for the first time. However, we know that our state needs to be investing in clean energy, and we need to be accelerating the transition to clean electricity as quickly as possible. And investing in clean energy for public buildings is, I would say, one of the most financially responsible ways to make those clean energy investments because of the savings it will result for taxpayers.
My final question.
Stevenson was going to just, I think he was making a comment on this
point. Well, I just wanted to ask Representative Garofalo if he was aware, if he could tell me, do fossil fuels have any subsidies from state or federal government? I'm just wondering.
Yeah.
Representative Garofalo.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, there are energy producers, they all receive subsidies, deductions, and credits for investments, but there's nothing that specifically says. Well, I guess carbon capture, you'd classify that as a new subsidy that's been created recently. But generally, on the investment side, there's not preferences or set asides. They all get deductions for investments and credits. It's not a question for this testifier, but maybe for future testifiers would just be. So on solar installations right now, we got a 30% federal tax credit on the front side. We have incentives coming along in the form of this bill and others. Just how much of the installation cost needs to be subsidized in order for it to be cost effective and to get the communities that are wanted involved in there? What percentage of that, what does it need to be? This testifier certainly doesn't have to shoulder the response.
That's a good question, and we can certainly continue to look into the question that you have. So we will.
Well, Madam Chair, the question wasn't for you. It was the statement that I was making that this testifier doesn't have to answer, but maybe as future testifiers come forward, just let us know of that total cost, not the price, but the cost, just let us know how much percentage of it needs to be subsidized or incentivized. We all know that you're getting 30% right now. in the form of a subsidy from the tax credit, but how much more it needs to be cost effective. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Ms. Ricker, do you have a response to that at all?
I'd be happy to, Madam Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative. The bill is structured such that the Department of Commerce can determine the appropriate grant amount for each project, which I think can help address your concern. And one of the other important components of this bill, which I don't believe has been addressed yet today, is that it authorizes the department to provide technical assistance. In fact, I think it requires the department to provide technical assistance to public entities seeking to install solar. And that information gap is often a very challenging barrier for public entities to overcome, especially those with small staff and potentially limited expertise in clean energy technology, which is, you know, still relatively new to many. So I think that's another important component of the way this program is structured.
Thank you, Ms. Ricker. And Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question kind of along Representative Garofalo's lines of questions. So is it my understanding that, let's say, the Department of Commerce would build, essentially release these funds to government entity X, and it's for $1 million to build the project, who would actually receive the tax credits? Would the tax credits be used as part of the purchase price? So let's say, if the total cost is $1 million, will the entity get the $1 million, or will they get 70% because of the tax credits of the cost? How does that work? Or will the state of Minnesota pay for the whole $1 million, and then the tax credits just get to be on top of that? Or is there matching dollars that are required from the local unit of government? And then those cost savings, it's a couple of the testifiers said it's going to save taxpayers money. Will the funds that are saved that aren't going to utility bills be required to be returned to the taxpayers? Or how does that work?
Representative Ryer, would you like to respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative. So there are a few things in there. First of all, if you look at the average cost of a 40-kilowatt solar installation on a flat roof, it's about $135,000, and that's the max they can have. So we won't be looking at million-dollar grants, just to level set the scope of this project. The other part is to say tax credits come and go. They may or may not be there. And so I wouldn't want to make a commitment to what the financing would be. Again, it goes back to the commissioner to say, how will this be implemented specifically around those matters? I would expect it to be fair to the community. I would expect it to be fair to the state of Minnesota. And I would also expect the local government unit to then be able to use the savings to fund the operations and the amenities and all of the things in their community that they would otherwise be investing their scarce and valuable resources on, their taxpayer dollars.
Thank you, Madam. So it won't actually save, there's no guarantee that we'll save taxpayers' money in this bill.
Representative Breyer.
Madam Chair, Representative, we are not putting restrictions on what local governments do. They know their needs better than we do. We know, we trust them to make decisions about how to use that resource. If natural gas went down, if other types of energy went down, we wouldn't expect them to change their budget and give it back to the taxpayers. This is similar in my mind. We expect them to use their funds as best they can.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I think with that, we'll go on to our last testifier. Aurora Vautrin with the 100% campaign. Welcome to committee. Please welcome back to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Aurora Vautrin, and I am the legislative and political director for the Minnesota 100% campaign. Thank you, Chair Acomb and members of the committee and staff for the opportunity to testify today. And thank you to Representative Ryer for authoring this bill that we are thrilled to be in support of. The 100% campaign is a cross-sector, statewide, multiracial, intersectional campaign to build an equitable, clean energy future for everyone in Minnesota. Representative Liz Ryer's House File 747 is a bill to establish a solar grant program for public buildings. The bill would create a fund program at the Minnesota Department of Commerce to support the development of solar generation systems that would be installed in public buildings owned by local governments. The program establishes a robust process for evaluating local governments' energy conservation needs, requesting proposals from governments, utilities, or developers, providing technical assistance, and then administrating the grants. This bill will meet a real need among Minnesota's local governments. This year, 16 Minnesota cities have come together to declare climate emergencies. But acknowledging our shared challenge is just a start. Many communities have already started to take action at a local level. As of March 2022, 13 cities and one county have created climate action plans in response to the public demand for locally grounded, effective, and equitable clean energy and climate solutions. Making it easier for local governments to finance solar is a practical way our state government can help cities implement their plans. Installing solar on public buildings will meet the goals of virtually all of these plans by lowering local governments' electricity bills, cutting their greenhouse gas emissions, and generating local family-supporting jobs. We want all communities to benefit from the clean energy transition, regardless of how big or small, and Representative Ryer's bill helps do that. It helps ensure all communities can enjoy the benefits of less pollution and lower energy costs over time, even if they can't quite afford the upfront costs of solar. Please support House File 474. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Watson. With that, is there anyone else that wants to testify to this bill? Seeing none, we'll see. Are any discussion or questions from members? Representative Swazinski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ryer, why are you only allowing this to be on buildings? Why wouldn't you allow these to be self-standing? It's my understanding that rooftop solar is probably one of the most expensive way to actually install solar. Why wouldn't you like allow it to be, you know, on a post in the playground or something like that? Does it have to be on the building?
Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, Representative, it can also be adjacent to the building.
Okay. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then just a follow-up. So, you know, obviously there's the other bills that are connected to this committee was passed off, the requirement to, if you do emit CO2, that you have to buy RECs in the bill that was passed a couple of weeks ago. Who will own the RECs? Will the state of Minnesota own the RECs because we're the ones that are actually paying for it? That are created, will the developer who receives the state money in order to make it affordable keep the RECs, or will the local unit of government? How will that? Can we request that? Who would own that?
Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, Representative, ownership goes to the grant recipient. It goes to the local unit of government.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then nothing was answered. Do the cities have to match, or the local unit government have to put up any money of their own to build these projects?
Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, Representative, as the testifier said, it will be determined by on a case-by-case basis. They can use judgment to say what are the means of the community. However, as a bedrock principle of it, I think that this should be a zero barrier entry into solar because the stakes are so high. We need to continue our path to addressing emissions in Minnesota and moving toward clean energy. There are small towns who would not be able to touch this if they had to make a match. And it's very important to me, it's a priority to me, that we make it accessible and available to communities that want it.
Representative Swazinski, did you have any follow-up?
I'm good.
Move on to the next.
Go on.
Representative Igel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question, you know, we listened to those testifiers, talked a lot about how a bill like this is going to be important because of the cost. And I've talked about it, I think, in every committee today I'm in. So for those that share committees with me, I'm going to talk about it here today, too. The Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that Beijing is considering moving a proposal that would ban exports of solar panel wafers and solar ingots to the United States. They make up 97% of the world's total production. if this goes into effect, the U.S. has no solar manufacturing that we'd be able to build out these solar panels. So my question to you is, how does this bill going to be actually even be able to work if something like that was into effect? And I think this is outlining the big problem here. How can we be moving legislation like this without any domestic supply chain or any domestic manufacturing of these products?
Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, Representative Igo, you know, I come from the business world, so to me that just has lights going off in my head about the business opportunity that I expect to continue to grow. That said, there's no requirement here. This fund is available to local units of government to use and to request as they see fit. If it's not going to happen, the funds won't be expended. I don't see that would be disappointing, but it's not a structural problem.
Representative Igo?
The point I was trying to raise there with my question is, if we do not have a secure supply chain for the solar panels, why are we doing a one-time appropriation into this fund to create all of this if the solar panels will not be there? And then I'll also raise the debate at the same time. Why are we using taxpayer dollars to invest in the way that these panels are produced in horrible ways to bring it to our and put them on our public buildings? I mean, these are serious concerns that I have and my constituents have. So, I mean, these are, I would prefer not a runaround answer like that, if you don't mind. Like, if we cannot get these solar panels here in the United States, why are we doing a one-time appropriation?
I don't think that it's a guarantee that we can't get solar panels here in the United States. Representative Ryer, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I've studied China long enough to know they say many things and many things don't happen. It's been an area of academic interest of mine for many years. And so my confidence in their statements is limited.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry I missed most of the bill presentation. But I just wanted to thank Representative Ryer for bringing this forward. I think this is a really good idea. And honestly, it's something that's long overdue in Minnesota and in the U.S. in general. When we look at other countries using up space that has no other purpose and putting solar panels on it to generate energy, that's a positive thing. And almost everywhere else in the world thinks of it as a positive thing. I also wanted to note that I'll soon have a bill for electronics recycling that I hope Representative Igo will be supporting, because I do think it's important that we use what materials we actually have here. And there's an estimated enough copper to make, 100,000 electric vehicles just based on what we're not recycling here in Minnesota. So I think there's tremendous opportunity for procuring the materials that we need to make solar panels here in the U.S. We just need to think outside the box a little bit.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering if the author could let us know, since your four or five testifiers said that this is the cheapest option, can you tell us what the per kilowatt cost is for both rooftop and standalone solar?
Maybe what we could do is bring up Mr. O'Grady. He might have some of the details about that. If not, that's okay, too. We can always get the information and get back to Representative. Representative Ryer, did you have a response?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Rep. O'Neill. Yes, if Mr. O'Grady doesn't have that, we'll be happy to get back to you.
Mr. O'Grady.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think there's a lot of what ifs in your question. It completely depends on project size, system size, what type of panels are using. There's a lot of questions, but we can work with you after this to get some broad estimates based on some of the companies that work in this space.
Representative O'Neill.
Madam Chair, so this is the only committee that this bill will be heard in. It's not going to state and local government. It's not going to commerce. This is the Energy Committee, and you told us repeatedly that this is the cheapest option. I want to know at least what the range is.
Mr. O'Grady.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, We can get you a range based. We would look at this program and see what would be the largest system we would do, what would be the smallest system we would do. I can get a polling of our 140 members and try to get an idea. They all compete against each other. So there's a lot of questions there that I can't give you an immediate answer right now, but I can work after and get you some numbers.
Representative Ryer?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative, I echo the preference for that approach because I can see that you don't want general figures. There are national figures on things that we could get you, but if Mr. O'Grady can do the work to get you something that's very tailored to this proposal, I think that would be good for all of us.
Representative O'Neill.
Well, Madam Chair, it seems like we're not really ready. I mean, there's a lot of hyperbole of this is the cheapest. When I ask real numbers, I get nothing. And when we had Xcel Energy here that day, I remember very clearly that they were talking about utility scale solar, which of course is much more efficient because it's utility scale and not small scale. And they have the option of siting it as perfectly as they possibly can to some of it tracks the sun. And because of all of the increased cost, inflation, labor, product, recycling, which we're not doing. Now you can say, oh, we're recycling solar panels, but really it's just the glass and the frame and the junction box and the wires, but the components inside are not being recycled. It's being either incinerated or landfilled. But anyway, so the day that Xcel Energy was here, the testifiers had said it was between 5 and 7 cents a kilowatt, and that's utility scale solar. So I can't imagine it being cheaper than utility scale solar. That seems impossible because that was when the PUC commissioner was here, if you remember correctly, and he said that with the current contracts that Xcel Energy is now receiving and in entering into, it's 5 to 7 cents a kilowatt. And, you know, I mean, I might know, I wish Representative Mecklen was here. He might have the current numbers, but I happen to know the last time was at Sherco, which I know you all despise, but in any case, it's 3.3 cents a kilowatt hour at Sherco, 3.3 cents. Utility scale solar is 5 to 7 cents, and nuclear is just a little bit above Sherco. So I have a really hard time believing the testimony, especially when you don't have real numbers for me, that this could possibly be the cheapest option. And maybe it's because it's 30% federal subsidies, and now the state of Minnesota is going to pour out a whole bunch, but maybe that's what it is. I'm not really sure. But I have a really hard time believing the testifiers saying that this is the cheapest option, especially when you're talking about end of life and who's going to bear that cost, who's going to maintain it, who's going to take care of panels when they break, who's going to take care of junction boxes when they break, who's going to take care of wires when they get cut or chewed by an animal, who's going to maintain it? Is the small little city that only has 2 or 3 employees going to somehow now have to maintain this solar panel on top of their roof or adjacent to their building? There's a lot of unanswered questions, and we don't even have a fiscal note. We're hearing a bill in this rush of this session, an unprecedented historic rush through these bills. We don't even have a fiscal note. So those are just a few of my concerns. We probably will never hear this bill again. It'll get tucked into an omnibus bill or something, but there's a lot of really, really unanswered questions. Well, let me just ask a very, very simple one that maybe can be answered. What is the efficiency rate? So what is the percentage of time that a solar panel is producing nameplate capacity here in Minnesota, not in Texas, not in Arizona, not in Florida, right here in Minnesota?
So Representative O'Neill, I think they the testifier said that they will get you the information. I appreciate your digging for details that are really important to this project and to many others. And I think that there's been demonstrated willingness to find that information and get it back for you.
Madam Chair, this is the Energy Committee. This is the only place that this bill will be seen or heard. And we don't have any, we have hyperbole saying this is the cheapest, but it's clearly not. It's clearly not. We don't have any information. We have no data to back this up, and we're just supposed to take their word for it.
Well, I think
that's not how we do legislation here at the legislature. This is just not how we do this.
So I think you're kind of getting down into the weeds instead of kind of being above and looking at the project as a whole. And so when you look at putting solar on a state facility to save them money so that they can take tax dollars being brought in from their communities and allocate them differently, I think that this actually is a win-win.
And so I appreciate that you have some concerns, and we're going to work to get you the information that will answer your questions. With that, final question from Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just you know, looking at the tailoring, when you get the information from Marion O'Neill's question, if you'd share it with the committee, I'd appreciate it. But two, just looking at other programs that are currently out there. So the way this is going to work, you're using general fund money for folks that are outside of the XL Center, XL ratepayers, and then you'll be using RDA funds. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, will schools be able to use this fund, or government entities be able to use this fund to participate in a solar garden construction?
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. That has not been discussed as part of this bill. This bill has been discussed specifically to the local units of government for their use within their community.
Representative.
Madam Chair, we've heard of, like, City of St. Cloud. We've had, I believe they testified that they had used the solar gardens, or I forget what city it was, but they use it as a portion, whether it's a school. We've seen where units of government have participated in a solar garden. And is it your belief, is it your will, that they could use a portion, they could apply for a grant, and you said in your testimony that they don't have to build it on the physical building, but they could build it in an adjoining area. Is it your goal with this bill that they would able to use the funds in this account and apply for them to build their portion and pay for their portion of a solar garden if they reside in XL Energy? Or would you like to limit that so that they can't?
Representative Ryer.
Madam Chair, Representative, my intent was that it would be connected to the locations that are currently not used for energy production. Traveling to other countries, you see widespread use of solar in places where it's relevant, where it gets the sun exposure that it needs. To me, this is another complementary piece that would open up more possibilities. So that is my intent, to have it be specific to the buildings or the adjacent areas.
And I will just say, if you look at the bill on line 2.17, it says 40 kilowatts or 120% of the average of the building. So it's not going to be generating enough for additional consumption. Any Representative Swazinski?
And thank you, Madam Chair. And just, you know, I'm just thinking of this, Representative Igo kind of spoke to it a little bit, and kind of the sourcing of the solar panels, and because they're kind of going on in near critical areas, is it your thoughts, because of kind of the rough nature of how some of the minerals are gathered globally, from the documented use of slave labor, that maybe we would ban, so that we don't have child. I think the idea of child slaves working in another part of the country, world, and then them being built by our kids, it's kind of really a juxtaposition. I think, if we'd be willing to protect, those projects that are going to go on our schools, which is where our most precious kids are, that we won't utilize products that are used with slave labor near our kids. Would you be potentially open for that if we would bring an amendment when this bill comes, possibly in an omnibus bill or something like that?
Representative Breyer.
Madam Chair, Representative, the issue of sourcing is a global issue. It's a national issue. It's being addressed at a national level, and I think that that's where it belongs. Of course, all of us are appalled by the things that happen, but there are many injustices in the world, including here in our own country. And so to me, I look at different levels of it. We must also protect our climate. Our children, my granddaughter, are at risk because of the climate crisis. And All of those things need to be taken into account, and I sincerely hope and trust that we will move to issues to resolve the sourcing problems that you're raising. But to me, this is not the place to, in one specific bill, in the scheme of things, it's real money, but in the scheme of things, it is not a comprehensive statement of state policy. And to me, that would just not be appropriate. And just to clarify, this is not for schools. This is the public buildings, but yeah.
Any closing statements as we as we lay over your bill? Any closing statements from the author?
Thank you. So there is homework to do, and there are conversations to have, and I welcome that. I appreciate the challenge of taking all the perspectives on a project like this, because we are innovating. We are moving forward into a new era in the world where we have to be adaptive and we have to find solutions to our problems. I am excited about the possibilities here because I know talking to city leaders and other organizations who represent city leaders that this is something that communities want, and we are giving them an option that they don't currently have. And to me, that's the epitome of local control. It's the epitome of investing in our communities, and I look forward to moving forward.
Next on the agenda, we have House File 772. Vice Chair Kraft is here to present his bill. Great. Welcome, Representative Kraft.
Thank you.
Kraft moves House File 772 be re-referred to the Committee on Labor and Industry. And Representative Kraft has an author's amendment coded DE1.
Yes, yes, Madam Chair, I do. Would like to move DE1 to get the bill in the shape that I'd like to bring it forward with.
Great. Any discussions to the DE? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay.
No.
The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. So, Representative Kraft, will you tell us about your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I'll start with, there was some good news yesterday in the information released by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and that for the first time we are on track towards our greenhouse gas emission reduction goals from the 2007 Next Generation Energy Act. Minnesota's emissions have gone down 23% from 2005 levels, which is on the path to hit 30% reduction by 2025, which is an interim target set by that 2007 Act. There are some qualifiers. The first of that is that COVID's impact on our economy likely played some part in this, and we should not expect nor want that impact to continue, and that our overall goals of that 2007 Act, which is an 80% reduction by 2050, are insufficient. Science indicates that in order to avoid the worst consequences of climate change, we should be aiming for net zero greenhouse gas emissions economy-wide by 2050, which I'm glad to say is the goal of Minnesota's Climate Action Framework. So it's great news, but the job is not done. With that, I'm very happy to be bringing HF 772 on commercial building energy codes to this committee today. Within Minnesota, buildings account for about 40% of our greenhouse gases, with commercial buildings being almost half of that amount. And in my own community of St. Louis Park, buildings are 60% of our emissions, and commercial buildings are two-thirds of that 60%. So this bill focuses on an important part of this sector, new commercial buildings. So for some background, commercial buildings are any non-residential building and any multifamily building that's four stories or greater. The State Building Code is a collection of state laws and rules that apply a uniform set of standards to the construction and modification of buildings in order to enhance safety, energy efficiency, and accessibility. And the Department of Labor and Industry, who will be testifying here shortly, is responsible for maintaining our state building codes, which includes the energy code for residential and commercial buildings. The department already updates this code regularly, achieving additional energy efficiency on each update. So now more about the bill and the DE amendment. This approach that is being taken is the thoughtful result of stakeholder collaboration that's been ongoing for years, including a report released jointly by the Department of Labor and Industry and the Department of Commerce in December of 2020. One key stakeholder is our cities, some of which have climate plans, which means that the need for better buildings with respect to energy efficiency and performance is something that many of our cities have been seeking for years. It's time for the state to act, and we can do so in a way that is fully consistent with our established statewide code adoption process. As I said, House File 772 is fully consistent with the way codes are adopted today. It doesn't expand or alter the scope of which elements of a commercial building are covered by the code. The bill simply accelerates the existing this existing established process for updating the commercial energy code while providing a measure of certainty for the department and our commercial building industry. It acknowledges that to decarbonize, it's best to make a building as energy efficient as possible as a prerequisite. The bill puts the energy code on the path so that by 2036, buildings will support being powered by carbon neutral energy. This transition in buildings is coming. What we're doing here is providing certainty for developers, electricians, contractors, and those businesses who create products for buildings, while also charting a path to hit our climate goals. This kind of certainty is good for jobs, it's good for our economy, and it's good for our environment. And along the way, we'll be seeing better, healthier, more comfortable, and more cost-effective buildings being built. So with that, I'd like to ask my testifiers to come up.
First on the list, we have Kate Bruchik, Deputy Commissioner from the Department of Labor and Industry. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kate Pruchek, and I am Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 772 as amended. The proposal before you today is a priority action in the Climate Action Framework to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the building sector. Commercial buildings in Minnesota emit approximately 20% of the state's greenhouse gas emissions through energy consumption. This proposal aligns with and builds upon the department's statutory responsibility to adopt model commercial energy codes and consider amendments to the code to improve the efficiency of a building. The agency follows a robust process of evaluating and adopting building codes. It includes consulting with the Construction Codes Advisory Council, a group of technical experts representing a variety of interests in the construction industry. The council frequently assembles technical advisory groups where experts and affected stakeholders evaluate codes and recommend amendments to best serve Minnesota. The agency adopts model commercial energy codes every 3 years and supports the statewide approach to maintain uniformity and minimize complexity. The agency is nearing completion of rulemaking to adopt the latest model commercial energy standard, ASHRAE 90.1-2019. It establishes the minimum standards for the efficient use and conservation of energy in new and remodeled commercial buildings. It addresses energy conservation requirements for all aspects of energy use, including heating, ventilation, lighting, water heating, and power usage for building equipment and building systems, providing design requirements for all facets of energy conservation. The bill before you today will put Minnesota on a path to achieve carbon neutrality in new commercial and large multifamily buildings by 2036 and improve energy efficiency in commercial buildings undergoing alteration or change of use. In addition to being a recommendation within the Climate Action Framework, this proposal is the result of the stakeholder work group convened by DLI and the Department of Commerce in the fall of 2019 and spring of 2020. As this committee knows, Minnesota is working hard to meet its greenhouse gas reduction goals. and improving energy efficiency in commercial and large multifamily buildings is a key strategy to help the state reach these goals, as greenhouse gas emissions in the commercial building sector have increased by 15% since 2005. Because the model code alone would be insufficient to achieve the 2036 goal, the legislation requires establishing efficiency and performance standards that results in buildings and building systems that can be powered completely by carbon neutral energy sources. DLI will engage a consultant to perform market and cost analysis to determine necessary energy efficiency performance enhancements, and will work closely with technical experts and the Construction Codes Advisory Council to develop these standards. Improving energy efficiency in new commercial and large multifamily construction means better buildings, lower emissions, and a healthier Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to share the administration's support for this legislation. I do have my colleagues with me today in the event that there are questions for the department.
Thank you, Commissioner. Next, we have Joe Dammel with Fresh Energy. Welcome to committee, Mr. Dammel, and please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Acomb, and good afternoon to the committee. My name is Joe Dammel. I'm the Managing Director of Fresh Energy's Buildings Program. As you've heard already today, Fresh Energy is a Minnesota-based clean energy nonprofit working to achieve carbon neutral economies by 2050. We really appreciate the opportunity to be here in support of House File 772 as amended. So I'd like to begin my testimony by noting a simple statistic, which we've heard already today, but that's that the building sector contributes to roughly 40% of greenhouse gas emissions in our economy. And while we can and must and are addressing greenhouse gas emissions in other parts of the economy, now we simply cannot meet our climate goals without squarely addressing the building sector as well. House File 772, as amended, represents an important step toward reducing emissions from commercial buildings. Updating Minnesota's commercial energy code to the industry standard would set us on a clear path to, as the bill language says, result in buildings and building systems that can be powered completely by carbon neutral energy sources by the year 2036 and thereafter. Passing this bill and then implementing the code would also unlock federal dollars and assistance to help Minnesota meet our ambitious climate goals. This bill sets Minnesota on a clear but flexible path towards addressing our intertwined energy and climate crises. It also builds on our longstanding leadership in energy efficiency and conservation by adding resiliency and the imperative to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to our state building policy. And in a state where we import 100% of the fossil fuels we use, building better buildings helps to keep our buildings or our businesses more competitive so they can continue to invest in Minnesota. The buildings we construct today will stand for decades, and building efficient, resilient, and climate-friendly commercial buildings will benefit Minnesotans today as well as future generations. So for these reasons, I urge you to support House File 772 as amended. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dammel. Next, we have Brian Hoffman from the City of St. Louis Park. Welcome, Mr. Hoffman. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Brian Hoffman. I serve as the Building and Energy Director for the City of St. Louis Park, and I'm actually thrilled to be here to share with you the city's enthusiasm to see this bill move forward. And we need to have a pathway to get our state energy code so that everyone is building high-performing, energy-efficient buildings. It seems simple, but it does need a defined path to have this be accomplished. Now, there are incredibly high-performing buildings being done today in this climate in this state. There are LEED buildings. There's some net-zero buildings. And so this is very possible. The reality is, though, and after having been a building official for about 35 years, we know that most buildings get designed and constructed to the minimum requirements of the state code, and it is, well, minimal. It's not a high design standard, but it becomes a default. So we need to raise that bar up however we can. It's for the benefit of the future building owners, the occupants, and the state as a whole when we start taking a look at reducing our carbon footprint. Now, let me just share with you a little bit of a direct experience on this, because I know that whenever there's a bill or a change being proposed, there's this apprehension about, oh my goodness, how will we do this? So in my position, it's really exciting because I get to basically work on the city's sustainability efforts towards our climate action plan. I also take care of our building construction inspection programs, as well as the management of our city facilities. So a few years ago, several now, but we had a policy discussion, but we had to replace a city building. So what do we do? And the city had recently heard from actually a group of our high school kids saying, you know what, we really expect you guys to do something and make right decisions for our future. And so we adopted a climate action plan, among other reasons. So when we were talking about, okay, we're going to build a new city facility, we said, well, what do we do? And after, there was a lot of good policy discussions. And in the end, it was, you know what, this building is going to be here for 50 to 100 years. The right thing to do is build the highest performing, most energy efficient building we can. So we went through a design process. I had the pleasure of working with a really great architectural and engineering firm. I spent a lot of time with them, probably more than they wanted me to. But I learned about the process they use and how we design this building, and discovered that we have the design knowledge now. It's really a matter of being very careful to attention to detail, selecting the right materials, the right equipment, lighting systems, and making it all work together as a package. So the building was designed, and the construction started. And in all honesty, I was a little apprehensive sometimes through this, you know. But I started learning that it is all so doable. And the construction went very well. Unlike a home, and we build very nice energy-efficient homes in the state, but commercial buildings are all unique. Right now, every set of plans is different. And so the contractors working on a commercial building have to follow the plans and specifications for that building. And a lot of the contractors working on our building had no idea it was a high-efficiency building or not. They had to just follow the plans. And so the construction went well. The building's been done. It's been operating. It's actually net zero certified. And our facilities staff, once again, weren't sure what was going to be involved, but we have learned that there's actually nothing special to do. The building works. It's comfortable for its occupants. It's been durable. And we have every reason to believe that this is going to be an efficient building for the life of it, which is, you know, 50 to 100 years on a building. It's much cheaper to do it right up front than to try to go back 10 or 20 years later and retrofit a building. Anyway, so with that, I just wanted to share that experience. This is a very, very reasonable way to get there through this bill and approach over a fair amount of time, and I do want to thank the committee for their attention on this. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. And the last testifier we have today, Tate Walker from the Minnesota chapter of the American Institute of Architects. Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Akam and members of the committee. My name is Tate Walker, and I'm the Director of Sustainability and Studio Lead for OPN Architects. I'm a proud member of the American Institute of Architects Minnesota, which represents more than 2,300 architecture and design professionals in our state. I'm here today to offer AIA Minnesota's support of HF 772, which would accelerate the adoption cycle for the commercial energy codes. AIA Minnesota and its member architects are committed to addressing the significant impact of the built environment on our climate. The built environment accounts for as much as 40% of carbon emissions and energy use. Making changes here could be the next big impact opportunity to make our state more energy efficient and energy independent. We're also experiencing a greater frequency of extreme weather events, which is already increasing costs and financial risks for all Minnesotans, farmers, building owners, local governments, and residents. AIA has been raising the ceiling for high-performance buildings for many years, and now it's time to raise the floor, the energy code. Our organization's ethical code requires that its members talk to their clients about the environmental impacts of their decisions on every project, and I have had the pleasure of co-chairing the AIA's 2030 commitment, a voluntary program that tracks our progress towards carbon-neutral buildings by the year 2030. And we've made significant progress towards that vision so that we can achieve these goals in a cold climate cost-effectively. My firm has been a signatory reporting its own progress for 8 years now. Additionally, I was able to contribute to the AIA's Framework for Design Excellence, which is a program that defines what good, sustainable future looks like for our buildings, towns, cities, and states. It is visionary, practical, and free. I'll just repeat that last part, free. Furthermore, when we recognize great architecture with awards, the framework provides the measure by which they are judged, both in Minnesota and nationally. Accelerating statewide adaptation for the most current energy code ensures that every community, developer, architect, and tradesperson is on a level playing field, because better, healthier buildings shouldn't just be for some. They should be for all, and the building code is an important tool that we can use to attain that equitable access. Energy costs have soared, and the record number of people have been falling behind on their utility bills, having to choose between keeping the lights on and putting food in the fridge. Improved energy codes can be especially helpful to low-income families by keeping their energy bills lower. The proposed standard would still go through the rigorous Minnesota code adoption process, where Minnesota-specific changes are made and stakeholders across the design and construction industry are consulted. The Department of Labor and Industry already administers a thorough and intentional process, and they are more than ready to take on the accelerated pace of review. Numerous AIA Minnesota members have supported the work of codes review and adoption over the years and have seen firsthand that the development department's progress for our state. They complete a thorough, thoughtful review while moving us forward on a path to greater energy efficiency and a reduction of our carbon footprint. We need to address the very real impacts of the built environment on our changing climate, and these provisions will help us do that. We urge you to move this bill forward for adoption this session. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walker. Anyone else here today that would like to testify on this bill? Not seeing any, we'll turn to member questions and comments. Representative Swinson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This my first kind of question is you know, we heard how it's going to help with people's utility bills potentially for low-income people. What is the threshold that this will kick in? So let's say you're putting a new toilet in a rental. Will you have to retrofit a whole building as far as when you permit? Because it says if you upgrade a building or do something to the building, at what point will this kick in?
Representative Pratt.
Chair Acom, Representative Susinski, thank you for the question. So this is, I think you're referring to the language about the updates to the building. I actually will ask my folks from Department of Labor and Industry to come down and talk about the definition of those terms and how those are defined. It's mainly the thrust of this is towards new buildings and significant changes.
Welcome to committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Scott McClellan. I'm the Director of Construction Codes and Licensing and the State Building Official for Minnesota. Madam Chair, Representative, I think I can address your question. The way the code is structured today, the code applies to new buildings, additions, and alterations to existing buildings. So this proposed bill would just highlight the fact that with the energy code, that it would operate the same way that it does with the building code, which is actually the way it applies today. It's just memorializing it in statute. So if you were to replace a boiler, you'd be obligated to comply with whatever's in effect at the time, but you wouldn't be asked to do anything further than replace your boiler, unless there was some associated wiring or piping that you were replacing at the same time. So it would have no impact on anything beyond that boiler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, like, could like the boy if like you use the boiler for example, if it's will this code be able to tell you what type of boiler to put in it?
Madam Chair, Representative, no, that would be up to you as the building owner, is there may be some efficiency requirements that are established in our current code or the federal government that establish that certain fuel bidding appliances have to have a certain efficiency ratio or ratio, so you'd have to comply with that, the efficiency.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. So from your reading, so if there's other goals that are set aside, so I understand what the code says, but if there's goals associated with it, to say essentially you have the building code, but then you also have goals associated with the that would say we don't want CO2 to be emitted from that boiler, would that essentially set up the game so that, you know, if you have a current natural gas or propane heater, whether it be in your house, whether it be in your commercial building or school, if there's other goals associated with this code change, would that then allow the state, through the coding system, allow you not to replace it with a like?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative. If when we go to adopt new codes, we do that through the Construction Codes Advisory Council, which is a council made up of about 20 people representing the entire construction industry, or the majority of it. And when we adopt new codes, we create technical advisory groups of those stakeholders that are most impacted by that particular code, as well as subject matter experts, mechanical engineers, contractors, building owners, and they together work on the details of the specific code. So if there were something that somebody wanted to introduce as an amendment, or the national code was required something, they'd all would look at it and they would all evaluate it and then bring a recommendation back to the full council. So every change gets scrutinized and looked at. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm guessing that's kind of yes, it's possible, but it would have a process that would have to go through that's traditional. It would just be a blanket, here you go, this is, you'd at least have to discuss it before. And are those folks on that board, are they elected or are they appointed?
Thank you. Sure, Madam Chair, Representative. They are appointed by the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, right. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How often does those appointments occur?
I'm sorry?
How often do those appointments, is it like a revolving door, or is it if we have a new administration,
That's a good question. I think they serve 4-year terms and they're renewable indefinitely, but we just appointed a couple of new ones here just recently that came off the board. Yep.
Sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a question for a rough estimate. So, you know, obviously this has the potential to potentially add cost. To from a building standpoint, and you know, has there been any studies done within the organizations or through the department that came and spoke? I believe it was Ms. Peruschek. Was that okay? Was that pretty bad?
Peruschek.
Peruschek. Sounds good. Has there been any cost estimates of what this potentially could mean industry wide? So if we are to adopt this, as an aggregate, what it potentially could cost renters ultimately, because all these extra costs get passed down to whether the lessees of a commercial space or if it's a apartment to those renters, like what's the aggregate cost of implementation and what that number could potentially mean to the industry?
Mr. McClellan.
Sure, Madam Chair and Representative. The costs are actually established at the time of rulemaking. So every time a new, in this case, ASHRAE standard is published for review, the U.S. Department of Energy evaluates it to see if it's more efficient than the previous edition. If so, then they charge states that you have 2 years to adopt this into law. So this is something we're obligated to do anyway, every 3 years. So the purpose of this law would be to accelerate that process. So we would look at each new standard and see how efficient it is and if that helps us get closer to our goal to maximize the efficiency of the energy code. But when we adopt a new standard, that technical advisory group will actually evaluate cost, and through part of our rulemaking process, we actually have to establish what is the projected cost. And part of the fiscal note that was prepared for this is recognizing that we need to bring in a technical expert every 3 years to help us study what can the market absorb, what's the cost associated with this, and what are the what's the technology needed to move this forward? So those specific costs would be developed at that time for public input and review.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a follow-up to that, that's a really excellent answer. Thank you. Let's look at, obviously it's a little bit more difficult to look at what's coming at us, but just looking retroactively, what's been the last upgrade to the code and that last estimate, what was the estimated cost of the last adoption potential cost increase? If you have that happen, if you're,
Madam
it's
Chair,
a lucky day if you got that.
Representative, I honestly can't say that I would know what the cost range is without looking at the hearing record, but I can say from memory that it was approximately an 8% and 7% respectively over the last two code adoption cycles of additional efficiency, and most of that was in kind of passive building elements. There probably was a cost involved with that, but I can't say it was something we even heard that there was an issue. Obviously, as we move forward and we're looking to squeeze more out of that building system, that becomes more challenging, and there needs to be technology available to help us do that. And there could be costs that we hadn't anticipated, but that will all get reviewed and debated amongst those in the technical advisory group.
Sounds good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Kraft, did you have something to add to that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was a comment on fiscal note. We had requested a fiscal note, hadn't actually received it as of yet, but I think that my colleagues here know that if you want to talk about it, you're welcome to talk about it. We'll have it in time for the next meeting.
Yeah. And I certainly know that the fiscal note process is taking some time. They are pretty overloaded, and as the drafting process is as well. So, Mr. McLellan, did you have any comment to it?
Regarding that, what we are envisioning for a cost of the rule and is not an appropriation, because that would come out of our operating revenue of construction codes, but it would be a small rulemaking, be on the order of about $46,000 for that, and then we estimate about $100,000 for that consultant service to study the market analysis, the cost, and the technologies.
Representative Hornstein.
Sorry, Madam Chair. So just a final. So in the preparation of that fiscal note, does it not reflect the increased cost to update state-owned buildings? Because that it's obviously that, because if you have a potential increase, you're going to have an increase. Like we have, I think, an open-ended budget appropriation to redo this building. And, if this gets passed before that, this building is, there is going to be a difference in cost for the new construction and the retrofit and the destruction of this potential room, from what I hear. How will that affect the state, and will that be included, and could we please have that as part of the fiscal note?
And
thank you.
We can get a quick response with that, and we've got a few questions.
And I'll be
Madam Chair, I'd like to just, so I think a key piece here is this is this existing process that we have today on building codes. I don't believe we have fiscal notes on building codes for current buildings when they're updated. So I don't think that's this is working in our existing process.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. First of all, thank you, Representative Kraft. This is such an important bill, and I just don't think we spend enough time on energy efficiency. In particular, I appreciate, Chair Stevenson, really, your bill last year, the ECO bill, was the first time I think we dealt with this in this way in, 10, 15 years or more. So I think this builds on the success of Chair Stevenson, and we have to do more. This is the low-hanging fruit. We talk about all these different systems, but this is where we get the best bang for our buck, and I just appreciate this, and I hope that we'll continue to spend more time on energy efficiency, because that is far and away, I think, the cheapest, easiest, and best way for us to both build the economy and address the climate crisis. So thank you so much for this excellent bill.
And were there any others? Was there Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Collins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to the bill author, on line 2.23 and 2.24 of the DE, which, by the way, came in after deadline. which is problematic for the opponents who now didn't have an opportunity to come in other than just a quick note. But anyway, so it says building systems that can be powered completely by carbon neutral energy sources. So this is beyond energy efficiency. This is the building systems that can be powered by completely carbon neutral energy sources, and this is to be done by 2036. Does that mean that natural gas, propane, and other things like that, fossil fuels, would be banned from commercial buildings and also multifamily housing units? Because that was mentioned in the testimony as well. And also, while I have the mic really quickly, is this bill going to the housing committee since it does affect multifamily housing units, which would increase the cost of especially low-income housing?
The bill is going to labor and industry next, and I will just note for the record the time stamp on the DE is 9:44 a.m., so it was in on time. Representative Kraft.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, thanks for the question. This bill does not contemplate a type of energy that is to be used, and it talks about getting to a point where carbon neutral energy can be used. As I mentioned in my opening comments, generally as you're trying to decarbonize things, the best way is to focus on energy efficiency and get the building as efficient as possible to leave yourself the maximum number of options to have the lowest carbon you can. But this bill does not presuppose or ban any type of fuel from being used.
Representative Collins. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing this. So hearing all of this is reminding me, you know, of a very recent situation wherein my house, which is about 100 years old, developed ice dams and started leaking, and so we had to cut the ceiling open, and guess what's in there? Not insulation, old newspaper. And, you know, there was a time in which that was a perfectly acceptable way for us to insulate houses, when that was thought of as being, like, standard practice and not a problem. But it turns out that that is not the best way to do it anymore. And especially with our changing climate, it really does have a huge impact, especially in my district, which is mostly low income, but also these very old houses. So I really appreciate that we're forward thinking with this and going to be building things that are going to be hopefully lasting more than 100 years and surviving the changes in the weather that we're having right now. So I really appreciate you bringing this forward, and I look forward to voting on it.
Closing comments, Representative Raff.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the excellent discussion. One thing that was briefly mentioned that I do want to also highlight is that by approving this this bill, by adopting this, that it will also will unlock federal dollars available through the Inflation Reduction Act on implementing building energy codes. So that there's a number of folks here that are working on that. So that's an added benefit here. Look, buildings are a difficult sector to decarbonize. This bill is not intended to get us all the way there. It's one piece, albeit a key piece, of a complicated puzzle that we're going to have to keep working on in order to achieve our climate goals from the building sector. But this is a thoughtful path that provides clear an understood path that should also help our economy and jobs. Climate science says that we need to be fully carbon neutral economy-wide by 2050. In order to achieve this, we need to start building better buildings, which, by the way, are also more cost-effective to operate and healthier and more comfortable to occupy. So I ask your support of House File 772. And let's see.
I ask for roll call.
Yeah. Sure. A roll call being requested. There will be a roll call. Representative Kraft renews his motion that House File 772, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Labor and Industry. Clerk will take the roll, and the chair votes aye. Representative Kraft?
Aye.
Representative Studzinski?
No.
Representative Altendorf?
No.
Representative Bierman?
Aye.
Representative Caro?
Aye.
Representative Garofalo?
No.
Representative Hemmingson-Yeager?
Aye.
Representative Hollins?
Aye.
Representative Hornstein?
Aye.
Representative Igoe?
Igoe, no.
Representative Newton.
Aye.
Representative O'Neill.
No.
Representative Stevenson.
Aye.
There being 9 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and the bill is re-referred. With that, thank you, Representative Kraft and all the testifiers. With that, our meeting is adjourned.